This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And today we start with the body. Yeah, we're going to get just a little philosophy 101 with it. So here's your philosophical question to start the show. Is the me that makes me found in the thoughts, ideas, and emotions of my mind? Or is the me that makes me found in the fingertips, earlobes, belly button of my body? Ponder it long enough while sipping a good cup of tea, and you just might find you're a philosophy major. Now, for me, it's the aging. At 25, my body kept up with my mind. If I had 10 big ideas in a day, I could count on MHP Body 25 accomplishing most of them, getting started on the rest, and making a checklist to start some new ones in the morning. But these days, my mind is still kicking out big ideas, but MHP Body 48 is definitely not keeping pace. I mean, if this old girl manages a 50% completion rate, it's basically time to celebrate with a nap. But my body isn't a used car or a historic house. I mean, it is me and also not me. Why so Descartesian today? Maybe it was watching the Olympics and noticing all those young, extraordinary athletes had such different bodies. A sprinter is not built like a gymnast. A champion swimmer body is so different from a gold medal pole vaulter. But all our Olympic bodies, maybe it was the recent conversation with a gay male friend. He was so distressed by the criticism and rejection he often feels for having what he described as an imperfect body. Maybe it was scrolling through Instagram Live and suddenly finding pop star Lizzo weeping.
But on the days I feel like I should be the happiest, I feel so down.
Lizzo typically uses IG to celebrate her large, beautiful body, but instead, I saw this.
It's fatphobic, and it's racist, and it's hurtful. If you don't like my music, cool. If you don't like Rumors the song, cool. But a lot of people don't like me because of the way I look.
You see, earlier this month, pop royalty Lizzo and Cardi B released a video for their new song, Rumors, which, by the way, debuted at number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100.
They don't know I do it for the culture, oh man. They say I should watch the stuff I post, come on, man. Say I'm turning big girls into pros, come on, man. They say I get groupies at my shows, come on, man. All the rumors are true, yeah.
And in the video, Lizzo and Cardi B are dressed in golden robes and armor, surrounded by larger-than-life imagery that calls to mind ancient Greece. But what should have been a celebratory moment for Lizzo was ruined by internet haters, who unleashed a toxic stream of offensive and racist comments about Lizzo's body. So now we're back at the start. What is this thing we call a body? It ages, it slows, it refuses to behave exactly as we want. For most of us, it doesn't even come close to conforming to rigid standards of perfection. So what does that say about us? How can we look at ourselves and at all the other bodies sharing the world with us and find a little more joy, humor, and pleasure, and a little less shame, stigma, and hate? Talking with me now is Brittany Cooper, professor at Rutgers University and author of Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Great to have you here, Brittany.
Glad to be here.
And also with us is Dr. Jason Whitesall, associate professor of sociology and women's gender and sexuality studies at Illinois State University and author of Fat Gay Men, Girth, Mirth, and the Politics of Stigma. Thanks for being here, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Brittany, let me start with you and this moment with Lizzo, because, you know, obviously she's this incredibly talented artist. She's also someone who really embraces her body. And yet this is certainly not the first time she's been fat shamed on social media.
Yes. So she released a new song with the rapper Cardi B. And she talked about receiving so many inboxes and hateful messages where people didn't disagree with the music necessarily or have issues with her as a musician, but rather simply derided her body. And that is really part and parcel of how we think about people of size, about fat people in American culture. They are the one acceptable group that we still think it is widely okay to discriminate against, to say negative things about, because we have this overarching idea that fatness is a choice and that it is an unhealthy choice that folks are making because they lack self-control. And that then gets tied up in these tropes around Black people as being out of control and of women as being over-emotional and excessive and out of control of their own bodies.
Yeah, can we stick with that for just 1 second about this notion of being out of control? You know, I started by talking a little bit about what we see or how we experience our own bodies, but it's also true that our bodies are always being read by others, right? Other folks are taking a look at us and making all kinds of assumptions or, you know, sort of reading onto us, not just beliefs about what size we are or whether we're able-bodied or beautiful or any of those things. They're also reading about whether we have self-control, whether we care about ourselves, whether we are loved or lovable.
Absolutely. Look, the level of policing that goes on of bodies in general is something that we really should be having this broader cultural conversation about. We judge each other quite harshly, and so much of it is projection of our own insecurities, of our own issues around desirability and who we want to be in the world. But that becomes particularly projected onto Black women whose bodies are seen and have been seen as a problem. So our bodies are seen as a problem because they're seen as hyper reproductive, right? And that we're having a bunch of babies that we can't take care of, or we are seen as loud and unruly and needing to be contained, or because we are in the main, you know, over the sort of standard notions of weight or healthy weight, we are seen as taking up too much space and as being unapologetic about it. So it's not only that, you know, Lizzo is a large person, it is also that she is a person with a lot of self-confidence. So you can be fat in the public as long as you are willing to be self-deriding, as long as you are willing to be ashamed, as long as you are willing to shrink yourself or to imagine that you deserve the kind of ridicule that you receive in the public. And so it is her resistance to that that also draws vitriol and people saying, why are you excusing your own negative behavior and not taking responsibility? And when you begin to think about that discourse about why are you excusing this and not taking responsibility, the racist overtones become quite apparent.
So, Jason, I want to come to you in part because I think we sometimes will frame, and not that Professor Cooper is doing this, she's actually quite good at not doing this, but we will often frame this discussion about bodies and about body shaming around women and femme bodies and with a, you know, sort of unspoken assumption that we're in a kind of heteronormative marketplace of desirability. And as we were beginning this conversation, kind of even within our own production team, we had to keep checking ourselves on that and sort of coming back to the ways that we also see very strict norms of desirability and of categorization operating in queer communities as well.
Yeah. You know, I think that when we look at communities for gay men, for example, if they possess a body or they desire a body that's not conforming to that kind of gay male beauty myth, they're often stigmatized. Looksism, it occurs among gay men. You know, they fat shame one another. And oftentimes it's done through ascribing a kind of feminine stigma to fat men on gay dating apps. So, for example, there's oftentimes that tagline, no fats, no femmes. And again, it becomes racialized, no fats, no femmes, no Blacks, no Asians. So again, I want to be clear that this is kind of an intersectional oppression. But, you know, feminine stigma gets attached to fat gay men. And so when you think about fat, femme, gay, that's embodying three identities that go against what is thought to be socially desirable for men. Or again, you know, Brittany used the term exceed, right? It's exceeding what's desirable for men. Grindr, for example, has been called out for a lot of its users deeming, you know, fatness unattractive or devaluing and degrading a gay man's femininity or, you know, relegating fat femme racialized queer people to the margins. So I think this happens, you know, quite a bit within dating apps for gay men. I think that it's also true that when we look, kind of speaking to this idea of fat femme and racialized, there's also people who don't feel comfortable even in some of the communities that are created for big gay men and their supportive others. Some authors have written about that oftentimes fatness in gay men's communities can be acceptable if it's in a hairy bear body or a body where the beard, you know, is providing confirmation that you're masculine, that it's a kind of regular guy masculinity. But there's an author, for example, who has talked about having little facial hair growth based on indigenous roots. And so this individual talks a lot about like feeling a little too brown and too femme and too queer to be a part of the bears. And I am quoting Caleb Luna there. So I think that even within queer culture, there might be some spaces that are supportive of fat gay men. I use fat, it's not a four letter word. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that there are folks who oftentimes don't feel like maybe they fit into some of those spaces because of the sexual racism in those spaces as well.
Jason, stick with me on space for a second, because I want to tie it to what Dr. Cooper was saying around, and this I get, right? This is like, you know, women's studies 101, right? Women taking up too much space is part of what's going on with fat shaming. It's not just about desirability. It's also about, right, actually occupying space. But more traditionally, right, men are expected to take up space, are expected to be large, big voice, right? And it's interesting to me that you're expressing a sense of an inversion that, in fact, that space occupation gets read as femme.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of it, in the example at least that I provided, is that there's a way in which obviously fat becomes gender. So there are people who have kind of written about this idea that if you think about somebody who was assigned male at birth and a fat body might include that you develop quote unquote breasts or wider hips, you know, the physicality in some way becomes read as gender. And so people have talked about being even misgendered, right? Because of the way that their body, again, kind of, I don't want to say betrays itself, right? But their body in some way doesn't fit these masculine norms. But I think it is true that one of the things you're indicating is that groups like the bears, for example, one of the reasons why they were able to focus on sizism within gay communities and kind of elevate this idea of this kind of larger hairy body is because of masculine privilege, right? You're able to focus on that size. I think bear groups also skew white. So that also means that, again, unencumbered by racism, right? You're able to focus on body shape and size. But I do think that this whole idea of fat being read as gender, I think, is also kind of important too.
All right, Brittany. So I'm interested here, sort of as Jason is making this point that, you know, larger size people don't necessarily always find that space that is meant to be positive around large size, around fat, around, you know, sort of categorized identities. It's not necessarily the space folks want to be in. And I want to go back to our Descartes example here. My body is one thing, but it is not all of who I am. And, you know, again, as our bodies change over time, we really maybe start to experience how distinct we are from our bodies. I'm wondering about sort of the limits of body positivity.
Absolutely. So, you know, as I was thinking about this and, you know, thinking about Lizzo, look, let me say, as I often say in my work, I am also a fat person navigating this in community. And one of the things that happens in this discourse around, you know, you may have some Black listeners who are saying, well, we like, you know, big folks in our communities. We like thick and curvy girls, right? And often Black women will say, well, I got shamed because I don't have a big behind. I got shamed because I'm too skinny. Part of that, I would just remind people, is again that we police women's bodies too much in general. But also the other thing that I personally experienced, which is why I resonated so much with Lizzo, is that we like thick and curvy, but fat, like there's a world and a body beyond the thick that is fat. And there is a deep disdain for that body, right? Or a set of projections about what that body should be doing that, you know, either she can sing real good in church or she can serve everybody, or she's the, you know, the cuddler in chief, which is super interesting for me because I'm not a hugger. But part of the reason that I wanted to give that context is really to say, so it becomes really hard then to try to think at the intersection of loving yourself and loving your body, thinking about health discourses when you go into the doctor's office and you're there for something that is unweight related and the doctor feels compelled to lecture you about your weight. And so we don't have to do a toxic body positivity thing because quite frankly, it is really hard as a fat person to embrace your body in this culture. I was talking to a group of people about this yesterday, and after talking about the issue of fat phobia, one of the conclusions from someone who would not listen to me was, well, we just need to stop using the word fat because that means unhealthy and it's a slur. And what instead, rather than thinking about body positivity or negativity, I think we should follow the work of many fat study scholars who say, look, fat is just a part of life. It is neither good nor bad. It is a thing that our bodies have a different relation to depending on where they are in life stage, in terms of age, in terms of metabolism, parenthood, stress levels, racial identity, because as it is connected to stress level, all of those sorts of things. And so we don't have to keep judging fatness or lack thereof. We just have to think about bodies and what they need and how we want to be in them and exist in them. And that's the world that I'm fighting for. And that's what you see Lizzo saying as well. She keeps saying to people, judge my music, you know, talk to me about the thing that I'm sharing with the world. My body is a vehicle, but really my music is the thing that I want to be in community with you around. And too often we treat Black women, I mean, anybody, you know, even, you know, queer folks, right? We treat folks who don't fit particular societal norms as all body and no mind. And so all we do is obsess about what we think is wrong with queer folks' bodies and their particular performances of gender and sexuality. We stress about Black women's bodies and the idea that respectability is not just about speaking a certain way or being clothed in a certain way, but it is also about this kind of like need to perform that you are worthy of citizenship. And that means not taking up too much space. That means not being excessive. And so there is even a fat phobia element to that as well, where we're all being asked, particularly women, to discipline our bodies to make everybody else comfortable.
Jason, I'm wondering if this notion of disciplining your body also resonates as we think about queer communities whose bodies are perceived as inherently problematic, right? So either trans folks whose bodies are not conforming to, you know, cisgendered norms of what we understand sort of sex assigned at birth and gender self-understanding and gender self-presentation to be, or whether they're queer bodies that might be gendered as we would imagine, but whose expression of sexuality and desire is sort of not in conformity. And so I'm wondering if that's part of where this requirement of disciplining the physical presentation of self maybe becomes even more heightened in a political and social space that calls all the rest of what your body is doing problematic.
Yeah, right. The idea that, you know, there's multiple levels of being othered, fatness and queered. You know, you had asked, for example, I think that when you think about the intersection of fat with transgender, where a person is violating two forms of normative embodiment, fatness does influence how trans bodies can be viewed. You know, it affects your gender self-presentation. There have been authors who have written about, as a fat activist who also identifies as a trans man, I'm kind of stuck here with this discourse that I want to love my body and all the wobbles and wiggles and jiggly bits, but also in order to perhaps feel comfortable in my body, I may need to alter my body. And how do I reconcile fat activism with trans activism? And this kind of idea of, for me, to affirm my body, I might want to have top surgery, for example, or something like that. And that can be very difficult. And that's not to say that fat and trans communities are at odds. One doesn't need to change their fat body, but trans people also have every right to change their body, right? And it's their body. It's not mine and it's not your concern. But I think that becomes tricky for some folks where they're trying to think about how their fat body and that in conjunction with their trans body may or may not be confirmed, how one might be quote unquote red, you know, based on the distribution of fat on one's body.
Dr. Jason Weitzel is an associate professor at Illinois State University and author of Fat Gay Men, Girth, Mirth, and the Politics of Stigma. And Brittany Cooper is a professor at Rutgers University and author of Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey folks, we asked you about this as well. Have you ever felt insecure or ashamed of an aspect of your body? Have you found effective ways to be more accepting of your body? You told us about it.
Hi, this is Betsy from St. Louis. Since I was 13 years old, I have struggled with body dysmorphic disorder. So there's always been at least one part of my body at any given time that I have been either insecure or ashamed. I recently realized that I attributed being fit, aka thin, to being of good character, as though there was some sort of morality quotient tied to the scale. While I know on an intellectual level that my body is just fine, it is proving tricky to let go of 30 plus years of self-sabotage.
This is Kayla from Fort Collins. I'm naturally quite muscular for a lady. I've always felt self-conscious about how thick my thighs are. In my mind, they look too big for the rest of my body, even though other people have told me that they look normal. I've gotten my body fat down to about 20%, which is lean enough to look toned. As long as my thighs look toned and muscular and not flabby, I can accept them being on the thicker side. And some days, I even appreciate them.
Hi, this is Elizabeth from Oakland. I had a pituitary tumor, and I ballooned up from 110 pounds to 210 pounds, and I stayed that way for 35 years. I starved myself, and it did no good. I got the tumor cut back, and I lost the weight. When I was overweight, everybody had a tip for how I could lose the weight. I endured years of people's opinions. I just mostly stayed to myself because diet wasn't working. And when I was able to get that resected, it made all the difference.
Hi, my name is Lee, and I'm calling from New Jersey. I've always had a tummy, even when I was slimmer and working out every day. As a dancer, certain body ideals exist, and that is not one of them. I've come to make peace with my more Rubenesque figure by focusing on how my healthy body affords me so many ways to enjoy life unimpeded. Also, looking at great art through the ages is a great reminder that what is attractive now was not always the standard of beauty. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Damien, and I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky. I had a disorder where I have spongy bones and my teeth fell out at an early age and permanent dentures won't stay in. So I was very self-conscious about this. However, over time I learned to just smile less and interact less with people. But the pandemic and the mask situation has come along and actually helped me because now people get to know my personality before they get to know my disability. And when they do come across that, they find out that I am a radiant, intelligent individual who just happens to have a lousy smile.
Hi, this is Deborah from Dover. I've struggled with body issues since I was a child, and mostly because my stepfather felt that at 11 I was too big, when actually I was just too tall for my age. And he put me on the Atkins diet, and he made me run at age 11. I'm taller and bigger than my half siblings, and so I struggle with these issues today, even though I'm an adult, because I just don't feel like I fit in with the rest of my family.
Hi, I'm Lisa from Eugene, Oregon, and you asked about body image. Of course there's a problem. I'm a woman. It comes with the turf of being a woman in the 21st century America. An effective way to accept my body is to do ordinary things and events in the course of my regular life, where the event leaders happen to also share my body type, and their body is not part of what the talk is about, and they do not act ashamed of their bodies, and their valuable talents go ahead and shine. They become a role model of how body shaming can become non-existent and a non-issue. Acceptance depends, for me, on lessening my self-talk about discussing my body issues. And if it becomes a non-issue inside me, then, and in my mind, then half the battle is won, as I become more able to tune out and ignore those people outside of me who would try to shame me for my body. Thanks for the topic and for thinking about it out loud.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Jerry Seinfeld on making a life in comedy.
This is a writer's game. If you can write, you succeed. If you can't, you will not make it. any comedian can be funny on stage, but the bullets are the writing.
Jerry Seinfeld on his film Unfrosted and more. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway. And let's turn now to West Virginia.
Find a vein and drain the black gold. Hoping to God that the timbers hold. Like my father before me, it's all I know. We live only to harvest the coal. To harvest the coal.
The song you're hearing? That's Luis Mossery's Battle of Blair Mountain, and it's telling an American story you may not have heard. Well, 100 years ago, this month, an interracial coalition of coal miners initiated the largest labor uprising in American history. Working conditions in the early 20th century mines were deadly. For a young man in West Virginia, it was safer to be drafted to fight in World War I than to go to work in the mines. For decades, these miners, some white men, some European immigrants, some black Southerners, demanded the right to organize, to earn higher pay, and to improve safety conditions. Tensions erupted when up to 10,000 miners marched to confront the mining companies and touched off the Battle of Blair Mountain.
Red bandanas that tell us what side you're on. Yeah, we're the rednecks of the Union 1921. We'll leave tonight 13,000 strong and take the fight to Blair Mountain before the dawn, before the dawn.
Local law enforcement and hired deputy forces battled the miners for more than a week, and the Battle of Blair Mountain did not end until federal troops arrived and the miners surrendered. In the short term, the companies were victorious. Hundreds of miners were tried and imprisoned. But the coal miners of West Virginia were not defeated. Resistance and organizing continued for more than a decade, and by 1935, they won the right to unionize. With me now to explore the continuing importance of the Battle of Blair Mountain is Charles Keeney, author of The Road to Blair Mountain. He also serves as vice president of the Friends of Blair Mountain and is a history professor at Southern West Virginia Community and Technical College. Professor Keeney, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
For those who are unfamiliar with the Battle of Blair Mountain, can you tell us a bit more about what initiated it?
The kind of straw that broke the camel's back, as they say, came from the murder of Sid Hatfield and Ed Chambers, two local law enforcement officers in Mingo County who had stood up for the miners and opposed evictions of the miners from company houses. So after Hatfield and Chambers were murdered, you had some very significant things that were happening in Mingo County, which was this kind of beachhead for the unionization efforts in southern West Virginia after World War I. Miners were living in tent colonies. Their families were starving. The state troopers came in, attacked the tent colony, stole all the food, and would not allow the UMWA to send in more food and supplies. And then they rounded up all the coal miners and put them in pens. Then when the one law enforcement officer who had stood up for the miners was murdered on August the 1st, 1921, 5,000 miners congregated on Charleston, where my great-grandfather, Frank Keeney, told the miners that the only way you can get your rights is with a high-powered rifle. He then told them to go home and await the call to march. In between Mingo County and Charleston, where they left, there was Logan County, which was another notoriously anti-union county, and they had to try to break the defenses that were placed along Blair Mountain and ridgelines that stretched for about 12 miles. The battle went for 5 days and was fought on a 12-mile front, but the miners were never able to break through Don Chaffin's defenses.
Tell me a little bit more about your great-grandfather, Frank Keeney.
My great-grandfather grew up on Cabin Creek, West Virginia. That's the home of famous NBA basketball player Jerry West, but before then, it was just coal country, and my family lost their land to the coal industry, which many families did during that time. The biggest inhibitor to economic development in Appalachia is absentee land ownership. They lost their land. He started working as a trap boy in the mines just after the age of 10. He made his way only to the sixth grade in school, but he self-educated. And during the Paint Creek Cabin Creek strike of 1912 and 1913, he became a leader in that strike, a strike that turned very, very violent, in which somewhere between 50 and 100 people were killed during that strike. But he led the miners to victory. And after that, he was elected to president of the union in West Virginia and president of the West Virginia State Federation of Labor. He was an ardent socialist and rather militant and not afraid to use direct action.
I think as we're speeding towards Labor Day, which, you know, for so many feels like, well, you know, it's kind of the last moment of holiday. You know, some places, schools sort of are marking their beginning there. But I'm not sure that we sort of retell enough in the broadest sense this history of what labor movements really were. I mean, I think it's still jaw-dropping for so many of us that it was this level of violence. These were not peaceful demonstrations in that sense.
No, not at all. And the fact that it was an interracial and ethnic mix of miners, you had around 20% of the miners that were marching were African-Americans. About another 30% were recent immigrants that had come over. And this was something that really scared the powers that be. One coal operator said, testifying after the battle, he said, you cannot imagine the terrorism that prevailed. Anywhere one could look, one could see a collared man with a rifle. Those are his words. They controlled 500 square miles of territory. The U.S. Army was brought in. The U.S. Air Service was brought in. But this idea of poor whites, blacks, and immigrants working together, when we know that those groups are often pitted against one another in today's political arena, that scared the powers that be. And that's just, and the Battle of Blair Mountain took place, you know, only around 90 days after Tulsa. So all of that's fresh on the minds of the people that are taking up arms.
Isn't this also part of the beginning of the language redneck?
Right. When you think of the word redneck, of course, most people think of this stereotype. And there are a number of different origins of the word redneck. But coal miners and labor pro-union people began wearing red bandanas in West Virginia. And so coal miners were called rednecks, and that meant you were a union man. If you said the word redneck in 1921, it did not mean anything close to what it means today. It meant you were a union man. There were black rednecks. There were immigrant rednecks. It was a symbol of their union pride. And miners would continue to wear red bandanas through the Black Lung Association in the 60s. And when teachers went on strike in West Virginia, they wore red bandanas just a few years ago. So it has become a symbol of labor solidarity and unionism. But because the miners didn't win the Battle of Blair Mountain, they didn't control the story. And so the coal companies and the media were able to say that the violence was not a product of this industrial autocracy, but rather the violence was this backward, ignorant, moonshine-drinking culture. It allowed people to be dismissive of individuals and the culture here in the region and why there was so much violence to begin with.
I want to go to this point that you made about absentee landowners. Can you say a few more words about that? Because that sounds like it's an analysis about economic conditions right now, not just 100 years ago.
Right. The economic conditions really haven't changed that much in 100 years. What they did is coal companies tried to come in, and railroad companies, steel companies came into the region after they found out the wealth of coal that was here in the 1880s. And of course, many people were already living on the land. And in order to get to the land, companies came up with something called the broad form deed, which enabled them to buy mineral rights. And so they could buy the land underneath. And so the land was stolen by these out-of-state corporations. That means several things. Number one, locals don't control the land and they don't control their own economic destiny. And it also means that the wealth that is generated in West Virginia doesn't stay here. And so, you know, there's billions and billions of dollars that have been made every year from coal, but none of it stays in West Virginia, or a very, very small percentage, which is one of the reasons that the place is mired in poverty. And the problem with that is the industry is able to control school curriculum and media around here and tell people that the only reason that you even have an economy is because of coal, as opposed to being the only reason you don't have any wealth is because of coal. So they're able to flip the script because they've been able to control the narrative since the Battle of Blair Mountain.
Say more about that control of the narrative as a historian, as a writer who is uncovering this and telling this story, which is both a family story, a community story, but also our national story. What were you taught in school?
Nothing. I was not taught at all about the mine wars in school. I learned from my family. The coal industry created something called the American Constitutional Association right after World War I, and they used that to control school curriculum in the state of West Virginia to deliberately take the mine wars and all labor struggles out of textbooks. For example, the largest industrial disaster in U.S. history took place in West Virginia, the Hawk's Nest disaster, in which nearly 800 people were killed, most of them African Americans, and where they were dumped in unmarked graves. This was in the 30s. Nobody knows about that outside of West Virginia because it's just been deliberately taken out of the textbooks. And if you understand that this is a history that's been erased, you begin to understand the worldview and the mentality of the people have here. I call it the mind guard system. You had the mind guard system, this police state that the coal companies used in the early part of the 20th century. Now I say they have the mind guard system in which they're able to control news, school curriculum, and information that people get and really shape their worldviews.
As you're talking about this, I'm thinking about the current debate raging around critical race theory. And I'm thinking, I wonder if it's actually more dangerous to a system of inequity to teach critical race theory, or at least as it's presented in these partisan battles, or to actually teach that there was an interracial coalition of working class people who rose up and saw their combined interest.
Right. America's labor history, and more specifically the Battle of Blair Mountain, challenged the very tenets and the very ideals tied with the American dream or the concept of the United States. Is it anti-American to challenge the capitalist system? Is it unpatriotic to take up arms against your company? So in many ways, this conflict that's started out being waged in the coal fields and is now waged in classrooms is in many ways a conflict over the very ideals of what America is and should be. And we need to insert race and labor and gender and those things into the classroom so that students are more equipped to better understand what's going on and understand why things are the way they are.
Is that part of why you are a founding member of the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum?
Yes, for several reasons. We created the Mine Wars Museum in 2015, and this was a number of activists and scholars and some union coal miners and locals in Matewan, West Virginia, who joined together. And we wanted to create a grassroots people's history museum to rectify the fact that this is a story that's left out of the classroom. If the institutions aren't going to tell the story, then we're going to tell the story itself. The industry wanted to destroy this history so much, they tried to actually destroy the Blair Mountain battlefield with mountaintop removal coal mining. And the Mine Wars Museum came from a number of activists and scholars, including myself, that led an effort to stop the industry from destroying the battlefield. We were successful in that effort. And that's a lot of what my book is about, and about that mentality that is in the coal field, because this history is simply not a part of the consciousness.
If someone were to visit the museum, what would they see?
You would see a number of different things. I have, for example, a poetry book that my great-grandfather had while he lived in a tent colony in 1912 and 1913. You see bullets that were fired on the Blair Mountain battlefield, things like scrip that the companies used to pay the miners. They weren't paid in American money. There's one particular piece of scrip that I just love that it just really symbolizes everything. And that's, it's a piece of scrip that says, "Good for one loaf of bread." And if you're a individual and you got paid with that, they're not only dictating that you can't spend American money, but they're dictating to you what you can buy. So when you see that and you begin to be able to put your hands on and touch the actual items of oppression, then you can begin to see why these miners were so militant and why they became so violent. It's not this backward, you know, feuding, moonshine drinking culture, but rather people that had just been pushed too far.
You all are planning a big celebration for Labor Day?
Yes. The Mine Wars Museum has formed a coalition with other groups called Blair 100. You can check out the website at blair100.com. And there's 4 days worth of events. The United Mine Workers is going to be reenacting the entire armed march, all 50 miles that weekend. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 events. Much of that was going to be available online for people who can't travel or may not want to due to the Delta variant. But it's going to be a lot of events. We've already had a couple of online events, but you can go to blair100.com and check that out. You can also go to the Mine Wars Museum's YouTube page and see some videos we have about it, as well as a video that tells people what's going on with the Blair Mountain battlefield today.
Just one last question for you. So it's been 100 years. I did hear you say a bit earlier in our conversation that very little has changed about the economic circumstances of folks who are living in these communities. What might be possible in the next 100 years? What are some of the steps that need to be happening now so that 100 years from now, there's not a historian saying, well, and it's still about the same?
Right. Is there a reason for hope? And yes, there is. I call it in my book, identity reclamation. Whenever the coal companies blast a mountain, they do what's called reclamation afterwards, in which they're supposed to kind of put the mountain back together, which is a big joke. You can't really fully redo your identity if it's been scarred and manipulated for generations. But what you can do is try to pick up the pieces and begin to take control of your narrative. That's one of the things the Mine Wars Museum is doing. And in doing so, we believe that we are empowering younger generations to take control of their own destiny. When we started our little museum 6 years ago, the little town of Matewan, there was nothing in the town. All the stores were boarded up, all the buildings were abandoned. Now 5 new businesses have opened up in the town, and this little tiny place is beginning to thrive again because of heritage tourism. So there are ways in which we can begin to seek alternative economies here, but it begins, I think, with education. It begins with the new generations coming up that is not have their ideology forced upon them or dictated to them by the coal industry or what they see in local, corporate controlled media.
Charles Keeney, author of The Road to Blair Mountain. Thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
Melissa, thank you so much for your interest in the story.
Texas, it's huge. It extends nearly 1,000 miles north to south and 1,000 east to west. Houston, Dallas, and Austin are diverse metro hubs, but it's also a state of farmers and ranchers and oil and gas producers. Texas prairies are vast, and its beaches seem endless. Even the sky is big in Texas. What is not big in Texas is government. The state legislature meets only once every 2 years, and the Lone Star State is shot through with a fiercely independent live and let live philosophy. Even the Democrats are libertarians in Texas, which is why it's hard to understand why state lawmakers have used this session to introduce an entire slate of bills targeting the health care, social lives, and families of trans young people in the state. When Texas Democrats left the state in order to deny action on a restrictive voting rights bill, they also halted this anti-trans action. But the cruel bills have returned with each special session called by Texas Governor Greg Abbott. On Tuesday, the Texas House held a hearing on Senate Bill 2, a bill that would ban transgender student athletes from playing sports. I spoke with Landon Ritchie, an 18-year-old activist and a trans youth who is a fourth-generation Texan. Landon authored a recent editorial titled, "I've been fighting for my right to exist since I was 12.
Since the time I could walk, talk, and think for myself, I knew that I was in some way different from my peers and those around me. And my parents, while they didn't necessarily like squash this part of me, whenever I would express it, they also didn't really know how to encourage me to be myself, especially in the state that we live in. My dad grew up in the Pentecostal church, left in his 20s, but still much ingrained, and he had a difficult time to a degree unlearning some of those values.
Talk to me a little bit about what it means to be an adolescent, again, middle schooler, who is simultaneously developing and expressing your own identity and having to take the adults in your life on that journey along with you.
So I came out just before the start of my 7th grade year. And because of the close time frame, I wasn't able to socially transition at school for that year. So I was living at home as Landon, and at school I existed as somebody that was not myself. And that was particularly challenging, having to not only navigate the awkward and uncomfortable middle school age experience, but also with this added perspective of living a double life, in a sense. There were plenty of instances where, because of my appearance, I dressed very masculinely. I had a short, quote unquote, boy's haircut. And I would get plenty of questions from people that I did and didn't know about how should they perceive me. And I didn't quite have an answer for that because I wasn't quite sure as well. The following year, or the summer leading into eighth grade, I was able to have my legal name and gender marker changed and attend school as Landon. And that was a relatively smooth experience, which is incredibly fortunate, especially since I'd gone to school with some of these same kids since elementary. They tolerated me instead of embraced and accepted me for the person that I was. But overall, I had a really good community at my school, had a good relationship with the administrators. Even though, you know, the previous year I wasn't out at school, I did disclose that I was trans to a few friends, to a few teachers that I felt it was relevant. But overall, the issues that I ran into, a pretty common experience of most trans kids in school is gym. It was my personal choice to use the nurse's restroom as my, you know, day-to-day restroom, but also my changing room for gym. But I was not allowed to, after changing, go into either locker room to wait for everybody to be ready. And even though I was allowed to be in the boys' activities, because they're, for whatever reason, gendered in middle school, segregated by gender, it was still a very isolating experience because, you know, I knew that a lot of these people had known me from fourth, fifth grade, and it wasn't the most affirming or welcoming environment to be in.
As you're describing this, maybe particularly Jim, because I know so many people can relate to the social awkwardness, the agony of gym class. And so I appreciate that example. It heightens and clarifies, and I think gives a point of entry for so many of us. Now, can you take that experience, and I want to connect it to the really important op-ed you wrote about feeling tired of fighting for your right to exist. So you've talked a little about family, you've talked a little bit about school. Can you expand this out to how that lack of a welcoming environment, and not only not welcoming, but aggressively countering your right to exist at the level of the state government?
Yeah, for sure. So this session has been especially brutal with attacks to gender-affirming, life-saving care for trans minors, including puberty blockers, which are completely reversible, and access to sports teams, and even the proposed criminalization of parents and doctors who support their trans kids by classifying gender-affirming care and support for transition as child abuse. So when you are growing up in this rhetoric filled environment, hearing it every day on the news, seeing articles written about, you know, the ways in which the state is trying to limit your rights and essentially limit you from being yourself, it's incredibly, at least in my case, challenging to go through your day to day knowing that this is happening at the highest level in your state. And that experience, that challenge is heightened for kids who don't have the same support that I have.
Does this make you want to leave your home state, leave Texas?
You know, I know many families with younger kids that are moving, but it's also a matter of, because I can, I want to stay and fight for as long as I'm able.
Landon, if instead of leaving Texas, you are staying to fight, what's your dream for what Texas might look like a decade from now or two decades from now?
I like the imagery of everybody within the state being an invaluable part of the fabric of Texas. And I think really what I want to see, which is instead of attacking vulnerable communities, the trans community, people of color, low-income families, people with disabilities, instead of these sessions being wasted on oppressing people, I want, you know, our government and our state to start showing up for those who need it.
Landon Ritchie, 18-year-old trans activist in Texas. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, people, you made it. We're halfway through the week, so come back tomorrow and actually every day, because we'll be back with more stories that you want to know. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.